Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about trust problems. It will develop our third answer to the question of why states don't always cooperate, even when they would benefit from doing so. Though the list of goals on the first slide looks similar to those for the lectures on coordination and collaboration problems, the theoretical model that I'll use to explain trust problems is a bit more advanced, and my attempt to convince you that it tells us something about behavior in the real world won't be limited to a brief, informal discussion of a small number of examples. Rather, I'm going to present the results of statistical analysis I've performed, demonstrating that the patterns implied by the model are evident in trade relations between actual countries. Those results are not entirely straightforward, and it's going to take some time to talk through them, but I think they're quite striking. I hope that they help at least some of you start to appreciate how the combination of game theory and statistical analysis can help us make sense of the world. Turn now to the second slide, where you'll find a model of trust. As usual, we have two players deciding between two options, to either allow imports or block them. Of course, in the real world, there are intermediate options, like tariffs and quotas, but we're going to focus on two extremes to keep things simple. Because the only way to take full advantage of the power of specialization is to trade, and specialization ensures there's more stuff to go around, as I discussed in the lecture on foregone benefits of cooperation. The model assigns a benefit, beta, to each player if they both allow imports, while giving each a zero if they both block imports. Those are the easy parts to understand. Things get more complicated when we have imbalanced trade, when one state allows imports, but the other does not. In that case, I gets a payoff of beta times EI, while J gets tau J. Here, I use the letters I and J as placeholders, because everything I'm saying works the same way, regardless of which one is player 1 and which player 2. That is, when I say that I gets beta times EI, if I allows imports from J, while J blocks imports from I, I'm telling you that player 1 gets beta times E1 if player 1 allows imports from 2, while 2 blocks imports from 1, and also that 2 gets beta times E2 if 2 allows imports from 1, while 1 blocks imports from 2. I'm just doing so more succinctly. Put differently, I refers to either 1 or 2, without it really mattering which, and then J is just shorthand for the other country. What about E? That stands for exploitation. It's the adjustment we make to the benefit of engaging in trade when that trade is imbalanced. And while I argued in the lecture on foregone benefits that imbalanced trade is not intrinsically harmful, I acknowledge that states don't always see it that way, for a variety of reasons. So we're going to allow E to take on negative values. It doesn't have to, but it can. I haven't written this on the slide, but you should take note that beta is always assumed to be positive, to represent a real benefit. But E can be anything from negative 1 to just shy of positive 1. If it's negative, that means that I views imbalanced trade as worse than no trade at all, since a negative number is worse than 0. Whereas if it's positive, then I certainly prefers balanced trade, but still prefers imbalanced trade to none at all. They'd rather have access to what Jay's selling than not, even if Jay isn't going to buy any of their stuff, which would help them pay for it. Finally, Tau, that's the Greek letter that looks a bit like a T, stands for temptation. That's the payoff a state gets when it blocks imports from a country that's allowing their stuff in. This is always positive. If nothing else, export-oriented industries in your country are going to make money. But it may or may not be larger than beta. That is, we're going to allow for the possibility that countries are mercantilist, that they see exports as good and imports as bad, misguided as that view is economically, without assuming that all states see things this way. Here's where things are really going to get interesting, and unfortunately, a bit complicated. Not only do I allow for variation in whether states are mercantilist or not, I'm going to assume that no one knows for sure whether the other countries they deal with see the world this way or not. Specifically, there are going to be two types of each state, just like there are two types of smitten in the lecture on game theory. And, as will always be the case in this module, we'll distinguish between the two types with colors, with the blue type being the one you'd rather be facing, and the red type the one you wouldn't. Here, Tau takes on a relatively small value for the blue type, smaller than beta specifically, which is important, but takes on a relatively large value, larger than beta, for the red type. And, as always, the probability that either side actually is the blue type is phi. So phi 1 is the probability that tau 1 equals tau 1 underline, which is less than beta, and 1 minus phi 1 is the probability that tau 1 equals tau 1 overline, which is greater than beta, while phi 2 is the probability that tau 2 equals tau 2 underline, and 1 minus phi 2 is the probability that tau 2 equals tau 2 overline, where tau 2 underline is less than beta, and tau 2 overline is greater than beta. That means neither player knows for sure who they're dealing with, but they know how likely it is that the other side is willing to cooperate. That is, they know how likely it is that they're facing the blue type, and they know the blue type's best payoff comes from allow, which we can think of as the cooperative outcome. For that reason, I will sometimes interpret phi J as player I's trust in J. Literally, phi J is the probability that tau J is equal to tau J underline. But since J prefers beta to tau J, when tau J is equal to tau J underline, and that means that J would be willing to stay at the cooperative outcome of allow if and only if J is the blue type, preferring to exploit I by blocking their imports when red, we can interpret the probability of J being the blue type as I's trust in J. Let's just recap before we move forward. I know that's a lot of information. We have two players who are deciding whether to allow imports into their countries or to block them. If both choose to do so, in which case we'd say that they are cooperating with one another, they receive some benefit. If neither allows imports, nobody gets any benefits, nor do they lose anything. If one side allows imports and the other does not, the player who allows imports is said to have been exploited, and their payoff may potentially be negative. It may also be positive, but even if it is, it's not going to be as good as beta. The player who does the exploiting, who's receiving their temptation payoff, might be better off than they would be under the cooperative outcome of balanced trade, but they might not be. It depends on whether they're the nasty mercantilist red type or the nicer, more cooperative blue type. Neither side knows which type they're dealing with, but they can make educated guesses because they know how likely it is that the other player is blue, and we can refer to the probability of one side being blue as the other side's level of trust in them. If you haven't written all the terms down, along with their meanings, you might want to stop at this point and do so. Listen to this first part of the lecture over again if you have to. It's going to be very hard to follow everything from this point forward if you're not comfortable with these symbols, and I'm not going to redefine them for you every time that I use them. I will some of the time, but not always. You'll do better in this module as a whole if you get in the habit of translating symbolic statements into plain English. That will take some effort on your part, but once I've told you what everything means, it's pretty straightforward. You should already be in the habit of doing that, but if you're not, now's as good a time as any to start. Okay, turn to the third slide. We're not going to consider all the possibilities here. Just one that highlights a new explanation for why states might fail to cooperate, even when it's in everyone's interest to do so. I should acknowledge, though, that under certain conditions, this model ends up predicting more or less the same thing as the model I used to introduce collaboration problems. That is, if the E terms are both positive, both sides are red, and both sides are fairly confident the other one's red, then both of the imbalanced trade outcomes constitute equilibria. And if the E terms are negative, both sides are red, and both believe the other is probably red, then they are both going to block imports and thus get a payoff of zero, even though they could have gotten beta instead if they'd cooperated and allowed imports. In other words, this model is more general than the one I used to discuss collaboration problems. It's meant to allow for a wider range of possibilities, including all of the ones highlighted by that model. What we're more interested in right now, though, is what this model tells us that's new. In other words, the analysis that you see on the third slide, which we're about to discuss, only deals with one possibility. That happens to be the most interesting possibility, given what we've already gone over. But I don't want to give anyone the impression that what I'm about to say is always true. The equilibrium we're going to discuss is one where the blue type of each player allows imports, but the red type does not. So it's possible that they're facing a collaboration problem. That would be the case if both sides turn out to be red. And if they fail to cooperate for that reason, that's not really anything new. The interesting part is that they don't know if they're facing a collaboration problem. And we're about to see that they might miss out on the benefits of cooperation just because they're afraid that they might be, even when they're actually not. That is, there are cases where both players are the nice blue types who would be happy to cooperate with one another if they knew the other side was also blue, but out of a mistaken fear that the other side might be red, both will block imports, and both sides will be strictly worse off. Yet if we could have convinced them to give one another a chance, they'd have seen that the other side was trustworthy, and they'd have entered into a cooperative relationship that would be stable over time. That's similar to a coordination problem, in the sense that if we can get them to the cooperative outcome, they'll stay there. But it's different than a coordination problem, because they don't even know that cooperation was possible. It's not just that they picked the wrong place to go to on Friday night, or have different formats for their electric outlets. They're genuinely and rightly afraid of being exploited, and that's not an irrational fear, just one that sometimes happens to be mistaken. The problem being that states can't tell when it is or isn't. We also can't say that a collaboration problem prevented them from cooperating in cases such as this, not when both types are blue and cooperation, if achieved, would be stable. Rather, we've got something new on our hands, a trust problem. So how does that work? Well, you see on the slide that the blue type will allow imports under the assumption that the other side will allow imports as well, if they are blue, but only if they are blue, blocking when red, provided that some ugly inequality is satisfied. That inequality compares the expected utility of allowing to the expected utility of blocking. On the left-hand side, I gets beta with probability phi j, because phi j is literally the probability that the other player is the nice blue type. And if they are, then allowing imports will produce mutual cooperation and bring I a payoff of beta. And allowing imports means they get beta times EI with probability 1 minus phi j, because 1 minus phi j is the probability that the other player is red, and when the other player is red, and I allows imports, I gets exploited. And the exploitation payoff for I is beta times EI. On the right-hand side, which reflects the expected utility of blocking, I gets tau I underline with probability phi j, because they will exploit j if j is blue, and the probability of j being blue is phi j. And the temptation payoff for the blue type is tau underline. And 0 with probability 1 minus phi j, because they get nothing if j blocks, which j will do if red, and the probability that j is red is 1 minus phi j. Note that this inequality must hold if ei is greater than or equal to 0. That should make sense to you if you're keeping track of what all the symbols mean. That just tells us that when the blue type considers imbalance trade to still be better than no trade at all, still not as good as balance trade, but better than none, there's really nothing for them to think about. Of course they allow imports. If they're fortunate enough to be dealing with a fellow blue type, that will bring them the nice beta that comes from mutual cooperation, whereas blocking would have given them tau, which is worse than beta for the blue type. If they're not as lucky, and they happen to be facing the red type, well, it's still worth it to go with allow, because that will bring them beta times EI, which is at least as good as what they'd get if they blocked, 0. In other words, when states take a positive view of even imbalanced trade, things are likely to work out. Take note of that. We'll come back to that later. What about when E is negative, though? Let's refer to situations like that as adversarial, and situations where E is positive as harmonious. When states view imbalanced trade negatively, as though exports are good and imports are bad, then blue types face a hard decision. Allowing imports gives them a shot at their most preferred outcome, but it carries with it the risk of being exploited. And when E is negative, they really do see imbalanced trade as exploitative. So it shouldn't surprise you to learn that the inequality I just talked about only holds some of the time. Specifically, when I is sufficiently confident that J is blue relative to some threshold. That is, if I's level of trust in J, which as I said above is one way of interpreting phi J, since that's literally the probability that J is blue, if phi J is at least as large as the blue phi J hat, then it's worth taking the risk and giving J a chance. But if I thinks the odds of J being blue are worse than blue phi J hat, they're going to block imports. And they do that despite knowing there's some chance that they will have passed up on an opportunity for mutual cooperation. For the red type, it's a relatively similar story. There's just two differences. One is that the red phi J hat is not going to be the same as the blue phi J hat because they have different taus in them. And the other is that we assume the red type defaults to blocking imports when they're strictly indifferent, when phi J is precisely equal to phi J hat. Otherwise, everything I said above holds here as well. That's probably too abstract for you, so let's plug some hard numbers in. Suppose that beta equals 2. E1 and E2 both equal negative 0.75, and tau underline for both I and J equals 1. Then the blue types of each side cooperate, that is, allow imports, if and only if they think there's at least a 60% chance of the other side also being blue. Where did that come from? The formula for blue phi J hat on the screen in front of you. The numerator is beta times EI, and both E's are the same. So that's 2 times negative 0.75, which is equal to negative 1.5. In the denominator, we have tau I underline, which is 1, minus beta, which is 2, plus beta times EI, which is negative 1.5 again. And 1 minus 2 plus negative 1.5 is negative 2.5. So we have negative 1.5 divided by negative 2.5, which is the same as 1.5 divided by 2.5, which is 0.6. So in this case, using an admittedly arbitrary set of numbers that I chose just to give you something to work with, even if both sides were in fact blue, and both believed it was more likely than not that the other side is blue, but only slightly more likely, they would choose to block imports. And that would be a mistake in the sense that mutual cooperation was entirely possible, but not a mistake in the sense that they're being irrational. That's the best course of action for them, given what information was available to them and the very reasonable doubts they had about one another. We can't fault them for that. But it's tragic in the sense that both could have been better off if they'd just taken a chance. So, that's what trust problems look like. Again, they're different than coordination problems, because the players don't even know whether cooperation, once achieved, would be stable. And they're different from collaboration problems because they prevent cooperation even when it would be stable, unbeknownst to the players. Before we move on to discuss whether this tells us anything about real-world patterns of trade, let's talk a bit about when the model tells us to expect trust problems to be most severe. That is, one reason I hope you'll agree the model is valuable is just that it highlights the possibility of states failing to cooperate even when both sides would have been willing to do so simply because they don't trust each other. But another reason is that it tells us that sometimes they don't really need to, and gives us a pretty clear sense of when that would be. We've already touched on one situation where the fear of being exploited is irrelevant, and that's when the E terms are positive, which I referred to as harmonious relations. In such cases, the blue types are just going to go ahead and allow imports no matter what. They're still hoping that they're facing other blue types, because they prefer balanced trade to imbalanced trade, but they don't really see the latter as exploitative, and so don't bother trying to avoid it. In a few minutes then, when I show you the results of statistical analysis I performed on data drawn from real-world trade relations, one thing we're going to look for is whether balanced trade occurs more often when relations are harmonious than when they're adversarial, and also whether that renders trust unimportant. There's another situation where the fear of being exploited isn't too relevant, when there's a lot of money at stake. That is, as beta increases, the phi j hats increase as well, ensuring that even if relations are adversarial, the blue types are more likely to go for it. Let's go back to the numerical example from above, only let's increase beta, the benefit of mutual cooperation, to 20 while keeping everything else the same. How much do the blue types need to trust each other now? Considerably less. Phi J hat has dropped to just above 0.44. If they think it's just a little more likely than not that the other player is blue, they'll allow imports now, whereas they wouldn't have above. So as the stakes increase, so does the likelihood of cooperation, because the players are willing to take bigger risks. If that doesn't make sense to you, try this simple example. Imagine I offer to sell you a raffle ticket for 10 quid, and that ticket gives you something like a 1 in 100 chance of winning 50 quid. That's a terrible deal, and you shouldn't buy the ticket. But it's not just a bad deal because the odds of winning are so low. Suppose the prize was not £50, but 50,000, and the odds of winning are still 1 in 100. If you wouldn't pay 10 quid to give yourself a 1 in 100 chance of winning £50,000, something's wrong with you. That's more than a fair bet. In fact, anyone who went around giving away that much money at odds that favorable would quickly go bankrupt. That's the basic reason why the model tells us that trust problems go away as the stakes get higher. When the amount of money that would be left lying on the ground gets big enough, states become more willing to gamble, and trust becomes less useful as an explanation for why they might fail to cooperate. And if we think trust problems play a big enough role the rest of the time, that means we should not only see an increase in the likelihood of cooperation overall as the stakes increase, but also a smaller and smaller difference between the rates of cooperation for dyads with high levels of trust and those with low levels of trust. So, to sum up, when we get to the results of the statistical analysis, we're looking for four things. First, mutual cooperation in the form of relatively balanced trade should be more likely when relations are harmonious rather than adversarial. Second, it should also be more likely when states have relatively high levels of trust in one another. Third, it should also be more likely when the stakes are high. And finally, we should see the first two effects more prominently when the stakes are low, perhaps even disappearing altogether if the stakes get high enough. Hopefully, all of those things seem intuitive to you now that I've explained the logic behind them. But I suspect that if I asked any of you to state clearly your expectations for trade based on the stakes, levels of trust, and whether relations are harmonious in the sense of imbalanced trade being seen as no big deal, I doubt any of you would have come up with that particular list. In other words, I don't think the model is telling us to expect anything too crazy, but if we find evidence for all four patterns, or even most of them, I think we ought to be impressed. I don't know that anyone would have thought to look for these particular patterns without a theoretical model like the one I just walked you through. In fact, I'm quite confident they wouldn't have, because people have been studying patterns of trade for decades, and I'm not aware of a single study that looks for evidence of all four of these patterns, particularly the last one, though plenty of people have shown that higher stakes are associated with more cooperation overall. Okay, turn to the fourth slide. There, I provide some more detail about the statistical analysis I performed. I analyzed all dyad years between 1870 and 1913, as well as those between 1950 and 2005. That means there's a separate line in my data set for each pair of countries in each year within those two blocks, totaling more than 600,000 observations. If you're wondering, I didn't include data from 1914 to 1949 because a lot of data are missing in that period, and also the world wars create statistical problems that aren't worth trying to deal with just now. The dependent variable is a binary measure of whether the trade relations between the two countries under observation were cooperative in that particular year, as determined by whether three criteria were met. First, that imports from country one into country two exceed $10 million as measured by the value of the US dollar during the year in question. The second condition is that the same is true in the other direction. The third is that whichever state imported more than the other one did not do so by too large a margin. Specifically, that the larger import figure not account for 75% or more of the total imports for that dyad in that year. So we're not requiring that trade be completely balanced, just that it not be too terribly imbalanced. There are relatively few countries that have traded with one another that do not exceed the amounts set by the first two criteria. So we're excluding pairs of countries that have very, very minimal trade with one another, those that have no trade, and those that have very imbalanced trade. And it turns out that about 35% of the dyad years in this data set meet all three criteria. That is, we're looking at a level of cooperation that's uncommon, but not unheard of. Now, let's talk about the independent variables. First, to get a crude sense of whether the two states are likely to have high levels of trust in one another or not. I included a binary variable that takes on a value of 1 if and only if country 1 has an embassy in country 2 and country 2 has an embassy in country 1. That is, if they have a fairly high level of diplomatic cooperation with one another, I'm going to take that as a sign that they trust one another, either because they wouldn't maintain embassies in one another's capitals if they didn't trust one another, take, for example, the U.S. and Iran, or because strong diplomatic ties directly foster trust, which is certainly one of the goals of diplomacy. In other words, I don't have an exact measure of trust, let alone of phi, but whatever the model tells us should occur at higher levels of trust ought to apply to pairs of states that have embassies in one another's capitals, and whatever the model tells us should occur at low levels of trust ought to apply to pairs of states that don't. I also have a crude measure of whether trade relations are likely to be harmonious in the sense of trade imbalances being seen as tolerable. This measure is based on how different the two countries' energy consumption levels are. Why do we care about that? Well, the assumption here is that trade imbalances are more likely to be tolerated when relatively few people lose their jobs due to outsourcing or their employer going out of business because it couldn't compete with a foreign company. We'll talk more about how trade creates both winners and losers and who is likely to fall into which category in the lecture on domestic politics. But for now, let's just say that it makes a big difference whether the two states have very similar comparative advantages, or whether they specialize in fundamentally different types of goods. In the former case, the benefits of trade are going to be a little more modest, but so will the potential disruption. Return to the example of rich republic and Poristan from the lecture on foregone benefits of cooperation. When those countries provided for themselves, that meant they both had people employed in the essential goods sector, which would include things like agriculture, as well as the leisure goods sector, which includes things like consumer electronics, automobiles, music, and entertainment. Once they decide to specialize in trade, everyone in rich republic involved in the production of essential goods got laid off, and everyone in Poristan who was producing leisure goods lost their jobs as well. That's a lot of short-term unemployment. That might not be such a big deal when both sides allow imports from the other, though, because over time, new jobs will open up in rich republic's leisure sector and in Poristan's essential goods sector. But what if Poristan isn't buying leisure goods from Rich Republic, but is selling them their essential goods? Then you'll have a bunch of unemployed farmers in Rich Republic, and relatively few new job opportunities opening up, because the leisure sector isn't growing. That's not likely to go over well. Suppose instead that Rich Republic started to trade with wealthy Westminstera, which is no better or worse at producing leisure goods overall, but has different tastes. Maybe Rich Republic produces a sweet corn-based whiskey, while wealthy Westminstera distills something a bit smokier. Rich Republic might be known for superhero flicks with big special effects, while wealthy Westminstera might be known for acerbic comedies. They can still benefit from trade, because not everyone in Rich Republic is going to like their country's corn-based whiskey and relatively mindless blockbusters, and there will be those in wealthy Westminstera who want to try something different, but we don't expect entire sectors of the economy to shut down when these two countries open up to trade. because their leisure good producers aren't competing with one another on the basis of price so much as taking advantage of heterogeneous tastes. If two companies sell pretty much the exact same good, but one charges half the price, everyone's going to buy from the latter, and eventually the former's going to go out of business. If two companies sell pretty much the exact same good, but there's slight differences that might lead some people to favor one over another with no clear favorite overall, then both can make money. Thus, we can expect that pairs of countries with similarly structured economies are going to have harmonious trade relations, in the sense that they aren't going to worry about trade imbalances the same way they would if they had very different economies, since that would mean they're likely to have very different comparative advantages and be competing on the basis of price rather than taste. I've used energy consumption per capita to get at that, simply because, for whatever reason, we've got data on that going back to the 1800s, whereas GDP per capita, a more conventional measure of economic development, is really only available from 1950 on. I'm not going to bother going into the details of exactly how I use energy consumption per capita rates to construct a measure of how harmonious their trade relations are going to be. But just know that this measure is going to imply that pairs of developed countries, like the US and the UK, should have harmonious relations, while dyads consisting of one rich country and one poorer country, like the UK and Mozambique, will be labeled as adversarial according to this measure. Finally, I have a variable that's meant to capture differences in how much money is at stake, the potential benefits of cooperation. Again, it's pretty crude, but I think it will separate dyads that stand to make a lot of money off trade from those that don't. That is, this variable doesn't measure the exact amount of money each state would add to its GDP if they were to trade with one another or anything like that, but it should take on higher values where the true beta term, if we could measure it directly, would also take on larger values. Again, I won't go into all the details, but just know that this measure assumes that there's more money to be made the larger each population is, and the closer together the countries are geographically. Two small countries that are very far apart, like Monaco and the Marshall Islands, don't stand to gain much from trade, because there's only so many goods being produced in each country, only so many new buyers for those goods in the other country, and it costs a lot to ship over that distance. Two big countries right next to one another, however, like China and India, stand to gain a lot. So, just to recap, we're looking at the experiences of all pairs of countries between 1870 and 1913, and between 1950 and 2005. And we're asking whether they traded with one another at a relatively high rate and in a relatively balanced way. Specifically, we're looking to see whether that's more likely to be true if their economies are structured similarly, as that would indicate that they're going to specialize in similar goods, competing on the basis of taste rather than price, and thus imbalanced trade should be tolerable. If their diplomatic ties are such that they're likely to have high levels of trust, if their populations are large and their countries close together, and if the first two relationships disappear as the potential benefits from trade increase. That's what our theoretical model told us to expect. On the last slide, you'll find a graph summarizing the results. Yeah, I know, it's a lot to take in. We'll go through this slowly. The x-axis varies the stakes or potential benefits from trade based on population and distance. As we move from left to right, we're increasing the population of one or both countries, decreasing the distance between them, or both. And that should indicate that they'd be leaving more money on the ground if they block one another's imports than would be true of dyads farther to the left. The y-axis varies the predicted probability of cooperation, in the sense of both sides importing a fair amount from one another, generated by the statistical analysis that I performed. That is, I looked at actual trade relations in the real world and used that to make a best guess about how likely it is that a hypothetical pair of countries with a particular set of characteristics would cooperate. The higher up we are on the graph, the more my statistical model tells me that we should expect a pair of countries with that set of characteristics to cooperate, based on what real countries have done historically. Recall that roughly 35% of dyad years met the threshold for cooperation discussed previously. So if the statistical model says that a hypothetical pair of countries would have a 60% chance of having cooperative trade ties, that's saying they are more likely to do so than the average pair of countries. Much more likely, in fact. The blue lines are the predictions for pairs of countries with embassies in one another's capitals, which again, we assume indicates or even facilitates a high level of trust. The red lines are the predictions for countries who do not meet this standard and thus probably have low levels of trust. The dashed lines are the predictions for countries with similar levels of energy consumption per capita, which, again, are assumed to specialize in producing similar types of goods, and so aren't going to see entire sectors of their economies put out of business by the other country, and should therefore see imbalanced trade as tolerable. For that reason, the dashed lines are labeled harmonious. The solid lines are the opposite, different levels of energy consumption, implying that massive layoffs could be at stake, and imbalanced trade is something to fear. They're labeled adversarial. The dotted lines, incidentally, are confidence intervals. They take into account the uncertainty around the predictions of the statistical model. That's not terribly important, but standard practice to include that information in this type of graph. So, the graph lets us compare the predicted probability of cooperation at any given level of stakes for pairs of countries with high or low levels of trust and either harmonious or adversarial relations. This allows us to evaluate all of the expectations of the theoretical model. Let's do so in order. First, we expect to see more cooperation when relations are harmonious than adversarial. So we compare the solid lines to their dashed counterparts. But we need to make sure we're making something close to an apples-to-apples comparison. That is, comparing the blue solid line to the blue dashed line tells us how much of a difference it makes for the two countries to have similarly structured economies given a high level of trust. Comparing the red solid line to the red dashed line tells us how much difference that makes when they have lower levels of trust. Comparing the blue dashed line to the red solid line would be varying two things at once and so it wouldn't be clear which one accounts for the difference. Fortunately, we get a pretty similar picture when we look at the two blue lines or the two red ones. In both cases, the dashed harmonious line is always above the solid adversarial line. So that means that in the real world, we find that countries with similar levels of energy consumption cooperate more when it comes to trade than those with different levels of energy consumption. We can't tell from the graph alone why that is, but I've argued that we should expect that to be true because countries with similar levels of energy consumption aren't going to be afraid of imbalanced trade because they're mostly going to specialize in producing the same sorts of goods. Goods produced in one country will likely differ from those in the other country only in subtle ways, and preferences for one or the other will come down to taste. Second, we expect to see more cooperation when the two countries trust one another. Here, we want to compare blue lines to their red counterparts. Again, we want to make sure it's as close to apples as possible. This time, that means we want to compare solid to solid and dashed to dashed, so that the only difference is trust. When we do that, we see something a little more nuanced than above. When the stakes are low, there's a huge difference between the blue and red lines, whether solid or dashed. When the stakes are high, though, there really isn't. In fact, the lines come so close to overlapping that we can't even distinguish them statistically. What we're seeing is that in the real world, pairs of countries that most stood to gain from trade have tended to do so more often than average, irrespective of how much they trust one another, at least as indicated by their diplomatic ties. When there's not too much money to be made anyway, though, trust matters a lot. At the lowest stakes, there's roughly a 5% chance of cooperation for states with low levels of trust, even with harmonious relations. Compare that to the almost 50% chance for high levels of trust and harmonious relations when the stakes are at their lowest. Third, we expect to see higher levels of cooperation as the stakes increase. To see if that's true, we just check to see if the lines tend to go up as we move from left to right. And they all do. That's more true of the red ones than the blue, because there's a pretty good chance that countries decide to trade with one another, even when there's not much money at stake, if they trust one another a lot. But across the board, it's true that increasing the potential benefits increases the odds of cooperation. Finally, we want to know whether the first two effects decrease or even disappear as the stakes increase. And I've already mentioned that we see strong evidence of that for trust. We don't, however, for harmonious versus adversarial relations. What are we to make of that? Well, one possibility, of course, is that the model led us to expect something that simply isn't true. But I wouldn't rush to that conclusion, because even if the basic argument was right, we might not find clear evidence of it using these crude measures. In fact, one very obvious reason why we didn't find evidence of the first effect, depending on the stakes, is that I didn't allow it to. I tried, but the software I used to conduct statistical analysis froze. I'm not entirely sure why that is, and it's not worth getting into too much detail here statistically, but suffice it to say that even if the theoretical model was right about that too, the graph wouldn't show it because of the way I performed the analysis. So let's call that inconclusive. Overall, then, we see clear evidence of three of the patterns anticipated by the theoretical model, and we couldn't really evaluate the other one fairly. Hopefully, those patterns make a lot of sense to you now that you've listened to this lecture. But when you ask people why countries don't cooperate more than they do, they don't tend to give answers nuanced enough to allow us to look for these sorts of patterns. For example, I doubt many of you walked into this module believing that high levels of trust tend to promote economic cooperation when the stakes are low, but only when they're low, because when there's more money to be made, states are willing to take bigger risks. Yet that's not only what our theoretical model led us to expect, but what I found when I analyzed real-world trade relations. I hope some of you are starting to see now how combining game theory and statistical analysis can help us understand the world better.